Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Welcome back to part two of Next on the Tee. We're not done yet. Coming up, more stories, more insight, and more reasons to love this game. Let's dive right back in. Part two starts now, right here on Next on the Tee, where golf legends live and your game gets better.
Hello, folks, and thank you so much for coming back and pressing play on part two of this week's episode featuring my conversations with John Mahaffey and Dr. Russell Levinson. As you guys know, John Mahaffey has become a wonderful friend over the years. Like I say in his intro, this is the 10th time I've been privileged enough to get to spend some time with him. He and I will look back at the U.S. Open because Oakmont is where John won his major, the 1978 PGA. So he can give us some perspective about the course, what it was like then versus now, J.J. Spahn's big win there. Plus, we talk about the Ryder Cup, right? He was a member of the 79 victorious Ryder Cup team. No one better to understand what that pressure feels like. He was the very first guy in that Ryder Cup to put a peg in the ground. You'll hear how he felt about that. And then I'll update us on his mystery novel series, the Nemesis series. He's five books in. Maybe there's a sixth and a seventh on the way. We'll hear more about that when John joins me here in just a minute. Dr. Russell Levinson, you guys know how I feel about Dr. Bob Jones, right? Every time he's on it, you get kind of a spiritual feel, a calm and a positive vibe that comes right through the microphone and into your ears, wherever you listen to your headphones or the speaker. Well, Dr. Russell Levinson is the exact same way. Every time I get to spend some time with Russ, it's a very moving experience. We learn some things. And in this time around, he's got a new book that's about to come out. It is called Witness to Belief, Conversations on Faith and Meaning. He's got 12 fantastic interviews that he's packed into that book. And we're going to get into a half a dozen or so of those, namely his conversations with Condoleezza Rice, Denzel Washington, Amy Grant, Jane Goodall, and Dr. Francis Collins. Absolutely stunning and wonderful conversations that he's had with them about their faith and their belief and what got them there. So I can't wait for you to hear both of these conversations with both John and Russ. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next 90 minutes or so. Okay, but before we get into all of that, I want to start off by reminding you about our wonderful friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2, UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Sure, this is golf, but so is this. And this. And this is definitely golf. And so is this. Hey, that's not golf. Oh, wait, yeah, it is. And no matter what your golf is, you're gonna need a store. No, a superstore. A place to get fit for a new club and walk out with it the same day. A place to find the perfect fit. A place to do whatever this is. Because this is golf, and this is Golf's Superstore.
Now back, and I'm humbled to say this, making his 10th appearance with me here on Next On the Tee is clearly one of my all-time favorite guests, and that is 1978 PGA and 1986 Players Champion John Mahaffey. John has been a treasure to me in this show since he first joined me almost 4 years ago to the day back on September 8th of 2021. As a player, John was obviously great, both as an amateur and a professional. Played his college golf at the University of Houston, where he was named a first-team All-American in 1969 and 70. John won the individual title at the 1970 National Championship, and he helped the Cougars to win back-to-back national championships in 69 and 70. He was inducted into their Athletics Hall of Honor in 1976. He won 10 times out on the PGA Tour, including that 78 PGA Championship, which happened to be played at Oakmont that year. We'll get into that. When he came from 7 strokes back with 14 holes to play to win in a playoff. He also won that 86 Players Championship by beating Larry Mize by a stroke. He won once out on the Champions Tour. He was a member of the victorious 1979 Ryder Cup team. In 1983, he was inducted into the Texas Golf Hall of Fame. He's written several wonderful books, including Hogan's Boy, A Journey in Golf, plus a golf-related mystery novel series called the Nemesis Series, which includes the individual books titled Shafted, Unfinished Business, Dead Quiet, Blindsided, and Hoodwinked. More installments, I hope, are on the way. You can find the 5 that are already out there by going to johnmahaffeyauthor.com or out on Amazon, and I couldn't be more excited. I get to spend some more time with John this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, John, how are you, my friend?
I am doing so good. You don't even know. This is
that
great
right?
To be on your show. Absolutely. I love being on your show.
I always enjoy having you here, my friend. You're awesome. We haven't had a chance to talk since the U.S. Open at Oakmont, side of your major championship victory in 70. What'd you think about how the course played and what you saw from J.J. Spahn?
I thought he played beautiful golf. It's wonderful to see that. But, you know, that whole golf course has changed so much when he took the trees down. I'm really not too sure how they did it, why they planted them in the first place, if they were going to take them down later. I think the golf course, just it didn't look the same to me as in 1978, obviously, without the trees. But I think he played marvelous golf. That's a hard golf course. Those are probably the hardest greens to putt anywhere I've ever played all over the world.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, where does Oakmont rank for you for the courses that you've played amongst the toughest?
My favorite.
Is it the toughest golf course you ever played?
Yes.
It is?
It is.
You know, is it because really of the greens?
Well, no, not necessarily. They got a lot of bunkers there, and a lot of them with the church pew bunkers that if you get it, you can get up against the lip of those things, and you have to come out sideways like playing over in Europe. So, you know, it's a tough golf course, a good driving golf course. I think it's laid out beautifully. I don't know. I loved it.
Did you ever get caught in the church pews?
No. I tell you what, the first day I shot 75, and I had a terrible year up to that point. I'd only made like $10,000. Not sure really how I got into PGA, but I remember I had an early tee time the first day, and I walked off the golf course, and I didn't even go in and get lunch or anything. I went right to the practice tee, and I worked on it till dark. Went back, and I thought I found something, and I learned from experience that you don't say, "I think I've got it," because you certainly don't. It won't happen the next day. But for 3 days, I drove the ball as well as I've ever driven it. I had some beautiful iron shots, and I putted like a dream. And I think that's why I was able to win the golf tournament. It had to do with putting it in play, hitting it underneath the hole a lot of times when the greens are so fast there. And I think I made the hardest putt that maybe you could have to win a major championship on the second hole of the playoff at Oakmont, with a left to right slider that if you miss it, it'd probably still be rolling. That green was so fast.
The 8th hole out there this year was amazing. It played right around 300 yards. What did it play back in 78? Because I don't know that too many guys could have reached it with driver if it was playing 300 yards back.
No,
then.
It didn't play anywhere near 300 yards. It was tree lined, actually. And I think part of the reason that they cut down a lot of trees, well, I know it was because a lot of the tees were shaded so much that they couldn't grow grass on them. Eighth was one of them. And the eighth hole to me played like it was like a 2 iron or a 4 wood. But today it'd be like a driver and a 3 iron for me for that par three.
John, looking ahead a little to the Ryder Cup, you played on the 79 team. Billy Casper was the captain that year. You were one of 8 rookies on that team. We've got 4 rookies on the team this year: Ben Griffin, Cam Young, Russell Henley, and JJ Spahn. Some people are saying, you know, hey, these are world-class players. They've played in majors. They're used to playing under intense pressure. But the Ryder Cup isn't just another golf tournament. It isn't even just another major. How much did being a Ryder Cup rookie impact your nerves? And how different was it playing in the Ryder Cup versus playing in a major?
Well, first of all, it was a real privilege to play for my country. And I thought that was the most important thing, to be able to represent your country and to hopefully play well. But I'm not so sure I've ever been as scared as I was walking to the first tee.
Is that right?
Never. I was shaking in my boots. It was two times I've been that nervous. One was trying to get my tour card, because I knew that would take a year out of my life if I didn't get it at the first shot. But then playing in the Ryder Cup, I'd lost the U.S. Open in playoffs. I'd won a PGA, I won out, worked hard and won that in a playoff. And I was like, I lost another U.S. Open. So I'd been under the pressure of major championships, but I don't think it compares. Because you got people that depend on you. You're representing your country, first of all, but then you also have your teammates. And most of those guys, all those guys are my friends. So you don't want to let anybody down. So I think you put added pressure on yourself for that reason. And I came into the thing not playing that well. And that really puts a little extra pressure on your game and on your mind.
So what was going on in your mind? As you put a peg in the ground, you know, for the Friday morning four ball, what are you thinking when you're standing behind it and getting ready to, you know, line it up and try to pull the club back?
Well, I kind of had a deal that I figured out if I could swing as hard as I could and hope to hit it, that it would go straight sometime. I nailed it. I mean, I did. And then, but unfortunately, that was about the end of it. I didn't play well from that time on. I don't think Hale Irwin, I played that first day and we lost, I think, 3-2. And then I played with Lee Elder the second day and we lost 5-4. And I was thinking, well, and I let him down. I just didn't play well enough. And I apologize for that, but you're not trying not to play well.
Right.
And I never gave up, but I just didn't have much. So I wish I'd have come into the event playing better. Although it really didn't hurt the end of the tournament at all. I think we won,
17 or 18 to 11?
17, I'm sorry, 17 to 11 was what it was. Yeah.
Well, you avenged the earlier loss from the Friday morning four ball that Brian Barnes was, you're competing against him, Barnes and Bernard Callicher, and it was you and Hale Irwin. But you come back and you beat Brian Barnes, who was a heck of a player. Beat Jack Nicklaus twice in a Ryder Cup, I think, at 75. But
right.
You defeat him one up in the Sunday morning singles. Talk about what it was battling against him and coming up with that win.
Well, I didn't want to go 0-3, for one thing. And so I think I fought maybe a little bit harder, but he wasn't playing his best golf either. It wasn't beautiful out there for either one of us. And I ended up winning the match and tickled to death to get the point. And he, magnificent man. I really enjoyed being around him. He was a character.
The U.S. had won 10 Ryder Cups in a row at that point, which I imagine comes with its own set of pressure. You don't want to be on the team that loses and breaks the winning streak. Did you guys feel pressure at all going in there? Like, hey, you're almost like an undefeated team that's going into the playoffs undefeated, which carries, a kind of pressure to itself.
I don't know if we thought of anything like that. This was the first time that Europe had come over. It wasn't just Great Britain and Ireland. This was Europe.
Right.
So this was the first year that they came over, and Langer and Ballesteros and Brian Barnes and the like came over. And, you didn't want to, we didn't want to lose to them. You know, we didn't want to give them a chance to say, okay, they made the right move, you know, to get all of Europe involved. So I think we handed them a pretty hefty defeat.
To your point, Seve was a rookie on that European team, and we all know about he and Paul Azinger, how they didn't get along and some of the shenanigans that went along with that in the 89 Ryder Cup between the two of them. Was there any gamesmanship going on out there in 79?
Not so much, not as much as probably there is today. I didn't have to play against Ballesteros at that particular point, and I never got on another Ryder Cup team. But as far as my interaction with Seve, I had a couple of opportunities to play with him in majors. One was the Masters, and the other one was with Shoal Creek in the PGA. And I remember playing the eighth hole at Augusta, and I think this was on a Saturday. And Seve got up there and hit the big old swing and hit a full hook, and it went all the way over in the second hole, the fairway on the second hole. That's about 100 yards offline. You know, I put it in the fairway. I couldn't get to the green. I laid up, and Seve plays it up the left side of the fairway, which would be the right side of the fairway coming down on number two. And then it lay short of a fairway bunker, hit it up over the trees about a foot from the hole, made birdie. I made par, and I'm thinking, so that's how you win the Masters. You know, yeah. And then as far as Seve's always been renowned for his short game, and I played the first two rounds at Shoal Creek with Seve, and we ended up tying. I think we were about 2 or 3 under par, and I was pretty good from tee to green, so I had a lot of greens, and I didn't putt as well as he did, and I think I missed two greens, made two bogeys, and the heavy Bermuda rough was tough for me to. I didn't know how to play the shot, so Seve, after we finished, he's waiting for me out of the outside the scoring tent. And he kind of said, John, come here, you know, like that. And he says, let me show you. So he took me over and showed me how to play, how he played the, like a little bunker shot kind of stuff out of that rough and stuff. He didn't have to do that. But I think if he thought you were a good player and he saw you struggling with something, he wasn't afraid to help you. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. Was there the same level of pomp and circumstance for those Ryder Cups back in 79 as we see today? Were there the dinners and the opening ceremonies and all the things going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we didn't have all the media, and we didn't have all the social media stuff coming around, you know, and stuff like that as much, but obviously. But no, there was all of that, of course. It was neat. It was a wonderful thing to be a part of. The PGA of America did a wonderful job of putting that on.
So where does it rank for you among the big events and the major championships and the things that you got to be a part of over the course of your career?
Got to be top five, easy.
Is that right?
Yeah, easy.
So if that's in the top five, what are the other four-ish?
Oh, good. Thanks. I knew you'd do that. Well, I tied with Ben Crenshaw for lower amateur of the U.S. Open in 1970 at Hazeltine.
Yeah.
All right. I went out and then I won the NCAA individual championship, and the team for a University of Houston team,
right.
Won the tournament itself, the team championship. I was runner up in the U.S. Open at Medina, lost to a playoff at Lou Graham, lost at Atlanta Athletic Club to Jerry Pate in the last few holes of the U.S. Open the following year, 1976. So, well, that's four, all right.
Yeah.
In the PGA Championship, I think being able to come back and beat Jerry Pate, who was in the playoff at the PGA, was, you know, just kind of, I wouldn't call it revenge, but just maybe a little karma. What do you think?
All right, so looking ahead to this Ryder Cup, what are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, I think I was listening a little bit to Reese, and I liked what he came up with, what he was talking about. Obviously, he knows the golf course. He's done so much on it. But I think we got guys that hit it a long way. I think it's going to boil down to who putts the best. I mean, that's an obvious thing to say. But I think with what he's saying, too, about the greens being somewhere between 12 and 14, I think players are going to overread putts. Because the ball is going to be moving faster. I think there's always going to be a premium on hitting the ball in the fairway. I think it's going to be interesting. I really do.
So is it, you talked about putting. I always think of these Ryder Cups, kind of like I think about teams going into the Stanley Cup playoffs. You sort of ride the hot goalie. whoever's the hot goalie is probably going to lead a team to the finals, if not winning the Stanley Cup. In the Ryder Cup, I always think it's the team that rides the hot putter. Most of these guys can hit the ball a mile. I'm not sure. Maybe the course could be set up to give the U.S. a little bit of an advantage. Reese talked about how the rough isn't going to be as penal as it usually is in a U.S. Open. So maybe that does play a little bit more into the U.S. team side. But I think you ride a hot putter. Is that what you're looking for? Whoever goes out there and starts making things, like putting the eyes out of it, is probably going to win the cup.
Scotty ain't too bad. Okay.
I've heard that.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's a heck of a putter. There's a lot of guys on that team that can roll it. And that's the whole deal, I think. That's the most important. And the thing is, I think they're going to all be together. I think they really want this, really want it badly. And I think Keegan's going to be a good captain. I applaud the move he made by not being a playing captain.
Because you think that was the right thing?
Absolutely, I do. I've never been a captain. I've talked to Lanny a lot. We worked together on TV for quite a while about Ryder Cup stuff and like that. And there's so much that's on your mind when you're trying to run the team and run this and run that, and, you know, put these guys together and, you know, give a guy a pat on the shoulder or a kick in the butt, you know, something like that to get them going, that you really wouldn't have time enough to concentrate on your own game. And I think he made the right move.
Speaking of his moves, what'd you think about the other guys that he ended up picking with his captain's pick?
I've been kind of checking out what Watson said about a few things, and I like it. In a way, I think there's too many captain's choices. If you had eight players that earned their way on there, and then you could pick four, I think that would make it simpler.
That's the way it used to be, right?
Yeah, I think. That's just, maybe I'm too old fashioned. I don't know. I don't know if there's any one perfect way to do it, but it just seems like to me, if a guy earns his way on there, it's a 2-year deal to earn your way on there. You're a pretty damn good player, you know?
Yeah.
So then you can pick four guys that are hottest right at the moment, you know, from the rest of the group you're going to choose from.
So how do you think it plays out? What do you think is going to be going on as we get into late Sunday afternoon?
Who knows? You know, I think they tend to surprise us all. I'm never really good at predicting that kind of thing. I'm not. Of course, you know who I'm pulling for.
Of course.
But I think we're going to have a great Ryder Cup.
Did you ever get an opportunity to play Bethpage Black?
I did not. And in a way, I'm kind of glad, because I don't think I could reach a lot of the fairways. I remember Hale Irwin was talking about when at the U.S. Open he had to play down the walkway because he couldn't reach one of the fairways. I don't know what hole it was. And I wasn't quite as long as Hale, so I think I would have struggled.
So when you look back over the course of the great courses that you've had an opportunity to tee it up at, do you have some favorites? Do you have places that you just loved being a part of and going out there and having an opportunity to play the course?
I love Pebble Beach. I love that whole area. I think they got some marvelous golf courses out there. I love Colonial because I learned that's where Ben Hogan and I played some golf together. And he was my mentor for 20 years, and I was around Shady Oaks and stuff some. And golf courses that you win on, obviously. I love Congressional.
Yeah.
There's so many. I don't know that you can really, and obviously Oakmont.
Speaking of Mr. Hogan, and I've had the privilege of getting Gary Player to be a part of the show every year, since actually season one, episode number one. And he talked about, you know, the famous quote that, you know, Mr. Hogan said to him early on in his career about, you know, how much do you practice? And he told him, how much you practice? Well, double it. Mr. Hogan was, you know, certainly told you exactly what he thought. What was it like for you spending time with Mr. Hogan? What was your relationship with him like?
You know, I've got to tell you, Chris, I've got to tell you that when I want to see him, that's a little too much Gary Player. Ben Hogan, to me, he kind of took me under his wing. I met him through Jimmy DeMeritt and Jackie Burke. Jimmy DeMeritt was Hogan's best friend. And because of that, I developed a relationship. And He actually got me an invite to play at Colonial before I was ever on the tour. So, you know, I spent a lot of time with Mr. Hogan, but he actually signed me before I was on the tour to represent his company.
Because is that right? Before you were on tour?
Yeah. He said, you know, I had a chance to win Colonial. Actually, the year I played, I was a professional, just turned professional out of college. And this was like 1971. I'd worked for Burke and Demerit for a while. And, you know, he got me in there, and I had a chance to win. And the last nine holes, I didn't play very well. And I lost by a couple. I think I finished fourth. Gene Littler won that year. And I'm back at the hotel at my Holiday Inn on Interstate 45, packing up, going back to Houston, and the phone rings, and it was Ben Hogan. And he says, you choked pretty bad. And I said, yes, sir, I did. He says, you know what? He says, don't get down on yourself. He says, you know where the Ben Hogan Company is? I said, yes. No, I don't. He says, well, find it and be there at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I walk in there at 10 o'clock in the morning, and he's sitting up at his desk, and I'm sitting down about 4 feet underneath, lower. You know, he's in that prime position, whatever you call it, the executive position. He's, you know, he says, kind of looked at me, said, as I said yesterday, you need more experience. So I made a phone call this morning, and I've got you to the Canadian tour starting at Winnipeg in 2 weeks. And you're going to go from Winnipeg all the way across to Vancouver. And there's about eight tournaments that you're going to be able to play up there, and you get you some more experience, play for money and stuff like that in professional golf. And he opens the drawer on his, on his desk, and he said, hands me a sheet of paper. He's got one. And he said, this is a contract. I want you to represent the Ben Hogan Company. And I said, but Mr. Hogan, I know you're not on the tour. I want you to represent the Ben Hogan Company because you will be on the tour. So I went up there I went up there and I played okay. And I came back and went to the PGA Tour school. He sent Gardner Dickinson to follow me every round of golf in the qualifying school. And I'll never forget. Well, I didn't know Gardner was there until he called me one night. That on the ninth hole, we played the old JDM course. And on the ninth hole, I drove in the fairway bunker off the tee, and there's water in front of the green. And I took out a four wood and I clipped it out of there and knocked it on the green, you know, and thought nothing of it. I'm kind of a cocky kid at the time. And so I get a phone call that night, and it's Gardner. And he says, I just talked to Hogan. Hogan told me if you ever hit a four wood, when you're trying to, you don't have to win this damn thing, just get your card. He says, you could have made a 12 on that hole, you know, to get caught in that bunker. So he says, just play it smart and get your card. And so, I mean, he had people watching out over me, and he watched out over me quite a bit, too. I'll never forget the time that a couple of years into the tour, I'd go up there in December and get some clubs made. Gene Shealy, his club maker, made my clubs for me as well. And if they had a new model, Gene would make a couple of sets, and we'd take them over to Mr. Hogan's office and take a look at him. And so Gene left. Clubs were sitting there. And Hogan said, all right. He says, here's the schedule for next year. And at that time, there were 40-plus tournaments. He says, I just want you to check off all the golf courses you like, all the golf courses you like on this. Because I played almost all the tournaments. I played a lot. And so he saw about, you know, 10 or 12 of them that I didn't check. So he took his piece of paper, tore it up, threw it in the garbage can. He says, that's why you're not winning. He says, every golf course you step on, you got to love it. You got to think you can win there. So once you do that, and I had a horrible time with Congressional. I played in the PGA Congressional, missed the cut by 1,000 shots, seems like. And I hated it because there were a lot of blind shots. And I told Hogan that. And he says, well, aim at a cloud or something like that. But you've got to learn how to play these golf courses. Well, when the Kemper moved from Charlotte to D.C. and played Congressional, I won the tournament at Congressional. A lot has to do with how Hogan had gotten me to perceive that I needed to know how to play and how to manage myself around the golf course and to love the golf course, not hate it.
So it seems like he might have been an early adopter of sort of the mental game, right? He's trying to get you mentally prepared.
There weren't any better mentally. Well, Nicholas would be close. but I don't think mentally, as far as golf course and believing in himself, stuff like that. Hogan's right there, number
one. Did you ever get an opportunity to play Augusta National with Mr. Hogan?
No, I did not. Hmm. I did not. He did give me a book when I was going to go play there for the first time of sort of suggestions of how to play certain holes.
Yeah.
So I get to the first day I shot 69. And, you know, not too bad. I played in the afternoon the first day and the greens get kind of crusty and stuff. So I figured that was all right. So the next day I'm teeing off early. The lead's four or five under. So I get to a birdie one, a birdie two. And on my little book, it says, whatever you do, do not hit driver off number three because of the fairway bunkers up there. Now guys blow it over there and almost knock it on the green. But so I'm cocky now. I'm 500 par. I'm tied for the lead. So I take out a driver and I cut it right off. I think I'm hit a perfect drive. I cut it right off that left side bunker. I didn't know that the fairway sloped to the left. So my ball hits, kicks left in the bunker. Seven shots later, I'm in the hole. I end up missing the cut by a shot.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. And so all of it because I didn't pay attention to somebody that I absolutely knew what they were talking about playing Augusta, right? Won two times there, right? So anyway, I get in the locker room and the phone rings and the locker room guy comes over and he says, Mr. Mahaffey, you have a phone call. And it was Hogan. And Mr. Hogan said, you hit driver at three, didn't you? I said, yes, sir. And he go, bam. That was it. He didn't talk to me for about 2 months.
Brutal. So how did you mend the fence? Did he finally just wait until he calmed down? And
I started playing better. And and that kind of took care of that.
That's awesome. John, just a couple more before I let you go. And I want you to update us on the Nemesis novel series that you're writing. I think the last time we certainly knew about the five books that had come out so far. I think you actually had six and seven ready to go. Is that right?
I did. Unfortunately, I had to take some time off, or I have taken time off. I didn't have to, but I did. My wife had a couple of medical issues. Right. So, so we've been at home. She's had to been in the hospital a couple of times and to rehab and different things. And we're doing great right now. I'm thinking about starting up number six. I don't know. I mean, I put the audio people, audiobook people on hold. I put the advertising people on hold. I put, publishing people on hold. I just said, look, I can't do this right now. And as soon as she starts kicking and starts running marathons, which I hope she'll do soon. I've got a book, and I know the title's going to be Limbo. And I know exactly where I'm going with this. If I ever start writing it, I wrote a couple of pages of it and I couldn't do it. My responsibility is to her. She, for sure. she got me where I am. She stuck by me when we were kind of down and out for a long time. So I'm very, very happy to be able to do this. We're doing this together. And I love that.
No doubt. And, you know, just along those lines, the wives play such an important part in the guys' careers out there. We know what Barbara Nicklaus has done for Jack. We know a lot about how the wives influence and come through for the guys, and whether it's taking care of the kids or being out there as moral support. Some have caddied, like Brenda Calcavecchia was out there caddying for Mark for a time. Talk about the role that your wife played in enabling you to go out there to do the things that you were able to do on the golf course.
Well, I've been married four times, Chris. So I'm going to tell you how Elizabeth, has been a rock for me for so long. As I said, through all the tough times and everything else, she's the one. I had some hip issues. I was a premature child and had some hip issues. And finally, Dr. Bertram down in Naples, Florida, Johnny Bench and Peter Jacobson took me down there and said, man, you won't be a walk. You know, you can't even play anymore. I was still trying to play the Champions Tour, and it was pathetic. I couldn't even hardly move. Anyway, so I got those done, and then some people, he made my legs the same length. And obviously they weren't that the same, that when before.
Is and that we right?
Always, yeah. So anyway, I'm not blaming him for anything. I wasn't playing at all that much anyway. And so about that time, I started getting some calls from the Golf Channel. And Elizabeth got calls from Keith Hirschland, who was a producer. He kept saying, I want John to try out for the Golf Channel. And he says, he can't roll over and play dead right now. Can I tell him? We want him to try out. So finally, Elizabeth sits me down one night and she says, look, she says, we're not making any. We're spending money, not making any. All right. She says, I know you want to play, but you can't. All right. Now, these people want to give you a shot at it. Why don't you take a shot? And I said, all right. You know, what makes you think I can do this? And she said, well, let's see. You know the golf courses. You know the players. You know the game. And you're not afraid to take a stand and speak your mind. And I thought about it for a second. And so the next week I tried out. And I worked 15 years for the Golf Channel. And it's all because of Elizabeth and Keith Hirschland. But Elizabeth specifically said, you've got to do this because you got no chance. You can't even play anymore. You know, not with these guys. So, you know, and I loved working for the Golf Channel. I love the people I worked with. They were absolutely awesome. Landy was a little tough from time to time.
Is that right?
He held a grudge. I beat him in the NCAA to win the individual. And that's the only amateur tournament he didn't win that he wanted to through his career. So I think he had a little grudge. But no, we had a great time. We had a really great time. Had some great producers. Lead guys that Bob Papa and Brian Hammonds and people that we worked with were great. And I miss them. I love the road, the team I had on the road, the camera guys, everybody, they were great. And we had a ball. I look forward to every tournament. We had a whole lot of fun, but such things come to an end from time to time. 15 years was a pretty good run.
Yes, it was. But I got to ask you, just because someone hands you a mic and a clipboard doesn't mean you're going to be good at it. How did you develop your style and how did you become so adept at doing the things that you did over those 15 years, having never done it before?
Because I knew what I was, well, this sounds egotistical, but I knew what I was talking about. I've been in those positions with those guys. Lanny's the same thing. I think probably part of the problem that we had, both of us thought so much alike. It was like having two analysts in the tower, you know? But maybe that's good because I didn't always agree with what he said. So then you had two opinions, which I kind of like to do. I don't know why I was. I think I enjoyed it so much. I had a guy named Jim Kelly that when I first came out there was a play-by-play guy. And I had one of the other announcers come up to me. He says, hey, buddy. He says, I know you're coming from the tour and all that kind of stuff. He says, but you know what? He says, a monkey can do your job. You know, you can't do this. You can't say that. Don't say this. Don't do that. Make sure you do this. Make sure you do that. So I was so self-conscious that day that I went out that Jim Kelly, I'm walking back into the compound. He's got his fingers pointing. He's waving me over with his finger. And he says, come here. He says, they hired you for you. Don't try to be somebody else. And from that day on, that was me. And it worked out okay.
So, you know, Keith Hirschland is one of my favorite people on the planet. He is.
And mine.
Such a wonderful guest on this show for years.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was looking for somebody to publish my books.
Yeah.
And he said, I can't really recommend you because I'm in competition with him anyway, because he writes the same kind of stuff. But he says, there's a lady out of Denver, Polly Lutowski, that's got her own book, self-publishing deal. He said, if I didn't have this publishing company, that's who I'd go to. I called up Polly and I'm with him to this day.
Wow.
So, I mean, Keith's been very inspirational is one thing, yes, but he's done a lot for me in my career, and helping me get going, different career.
What was it like having him in your ear?
Well, okay, here's the deal. I don't think I can say this. Can I? Are kids listening to this?
You can say it.
All right. No, I'm not gonna. So we're in Hawaii, and this is like our third tournament I've done with him,
right?
And I used to have a go-to. And every, I guess every announcer at one time or another has a go-to. And mine would be, they'd come to me and let's go to John Mahaffey. I tell you what, guys. So, you know, after about 3 weeks of this, Keith comes up to me and he says, hey, if I hear you say, I tell you what, guys, one more time, I want you to take that effing thing you got, clipboard, throw that damn microphone down, take the ear things off, and I want you, you're gone. You're done. So I didn't from that time on. And Keith left the Golf Channel after a while. I think he wrote a book that he probably shouldn't have. But anyway, we won't get into that. And so he kept listening to the Golf Channel, and we got to talking. And he called me up. He says, "You're doing a good job." And I said, "Well, thanks. I tell you what, guys." He says, "Uh-uh, you don't do that anymore." I said, "No, I don't." But he was a good producer. You know, he knew what made good television.
Yeah, I think he's one of the all-time greats, and you know, from a TV producer to just a human being on the planet, I think Keith Urson is one of the top.
Yep, no doubt.
John, before I let you go, remind our listeners again how they can go out and get a copy of the books that you've already published out there, plus also follow you online and on social media.
Well, actually, I'm not doing much social media right now, so the best thing to do is to go to Amazon, look up John Mahaffey Nemesis Series, and you'll see all the books there. Shafted, Unfinished Business, Dead Quiet, Hoodwinked, and Blindsided.
John, you're just like Keith, you are one of my favorite people ever. I tell you, you know, I had the privilege, like I said in your intro, almost 4 years ago to the day, September 8th, 2021 was the first time I had the privilege of having you on the show, and you've been a regular and a constant ever since. The talent that you have for telling stories, for what you did as a professional golfer, for what you did with a microphone and a clipboard in your hands, and just for what you have done as a human being, I think are outstanding. I can't thank you enough for all you mean to me.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you. And that goes both ways, you know.
I appreciate that very much. John, take care, my friend. You, your wife, and the rest of the family. I hope I get this privilege of talking with you again soon.
I hope so. Make it very soon. Okay, Chris?
I will do it. Take care, John.
All right, bye.
That's the great John Mahaffey, folks. And look, as a player, right? I mean, go back to the beginning, right? When he was in college and as an amateur, right? The guy that won a national championship on the individual level. You heard him talk about that in 1970. Brought two home for the Houston Cougars in 69 and 70. Won the PGA Championship at Oakmont in 78. Won the 86 Players Championship as well. And then for all the other things in between, a guy that was near or at the top of leaderboards for over a decade out on the PGA Tour. I wish he'd had a greater opportunity to play out on the Champions Tour. But, you know, I'd love John on the course. As an analyst out on the golf course, I don't think there's been anybody any better ever before or since when John did it. And I sorely miss him. The broadcast. Yeah, you know, I think we all sorely miss him. You know, having a guy like John, having a guy like John Cook, who's another wonderful friend of this show that has done that for years, to have a guy like Frank Nobilo, who's another wonderful friend of this show that has done it for years. To me, those are the three best that have ever done it. And like I said, I wish that we'd had an opportunity to revel in his career on the Champions Tour and had more time to have him out there as an analyst to get his insights. But as a guy who has now been on this show 10 times, and the 10 times over those 4 years, he has just brought something special each and every time he's been a part of this show. Every segment that he's done has been outstanding. The storytelling is outstanding. And one of the things that I love most about John is the sound in his voice and the optimism in his voice and the enthusiasm in his voice as he's sharing these stories. So a guy that, like I say, has become very special to me, and I will make it very soon the next time we get him back on the show. Coming up next is Dr. Russell Levinson, and it's such a privilege to get to spend some time with Russ again. Second time in the last 12 months he has been a part of the show. You're really going to enjoy this conversation. Before we get started with that, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com. I can't be more honored to say that now back in Next on the Tee with me is Dr. Russell Levinson. Russ has been a wonderful guest on the show. This is the second time in the last 12 months I've got to spend some time with him. Let me remind you about his background. He's from Birmingham, Alabama. Got his Bachelor of Arts degree from Birmingham Southern. He has a Master's in Divinity from Virginia Theology Seminary and his Doctorate of Divinity from Beeson Divinity School. He also has an honorary Doctorate of Divinity from Neshota Theology Seminary. He recently retired after 32 years in the ministry, the last 17 of those as the rector of St. Martin's Episcopal Church down in Houston, which is the largest evangelical Episcopal congregation in North America. Over the years, he's received numerous accolades, including a couple of appointments by Queen Elizabeth II. He is also the author of several devotional books, including Witness to Dignity, The Life and Faith of George H.W. and Barbara Bush, which takes an intimate look at their lives. Dr. Levinson had an amazingly close relationship with the former president and first lady that spanned almost 12 years. He's also co-officiated over both of their funerals. He's an avid golfer and the author of In God's Grip, What Golf Can Teach Us About the Bible. His latest book, Witness to Belief, Conversations on Faith and Meaning, is scheduled to be released on October the 7th. And I couldn't be more excited. I get to spend some more time with him this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Russ, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much, Chris. You probably used up most of our time giving us that hyperbolic introduction. So thank you. Makes me feel good about myself, but accolades not necessary. I really admire what you do, and I'm glad the way you connect with so many people, and just glad to have a chance to be back on with you and certainly to talk about 12 people who've become very important in my life over the last year, actually.
So let's get right into the new book. Last time, we got into the details of Witness to Dignity and your relationship with former President Bush and the First Lady, Barbara Bush. But what inspired you to build off of that book and now do Witness to Belief?
Yeah, it's a great segue. And I think I mentioned this in the preface. As you mentioned, it comes out in a few weeks. And Morehouse, the publisher, has just been wonderful. They were a great cheerleader when I started thinking about the idea. But, you know, actually, Chris, I would say, within a year of the release of the book, which was on the faith and our relationship with the Bush family, and particularly the president and his wife, Barbara, you know, I started to get lots of letters from people literally around the world, basically saying, you know, if these people have all that they had in the way of, I guess, what we would call worldly success, fame, success, influence, power, and yet still live their faith in a very vibrant personal way. Boy, if they can do that, maybe I should think about it. And I got nice letting. I'm glad you described them. They were the kind of people I hoped they would be. And I'm glad to know now to learn that they were, and up until the last days of their lives. But that, of course, as you and I shared when we were together before, as I said, you know, they did it do so much for our nation and our world, and certainly the state of Texas, where we love them. But in the end, their family, their friends, and their faith meant the most to them. And so I guess having received that kind of word from people about them, I said, you know, just as I'm sure you have done, I've been fortunate to meet lots of wonderful people in lots of different places over the years. And I knew several, but these are 12 that I personally invited that I really thought a lot of their own lives and the way in which they lived out their faith. And as people will look, you know, if they look at the book on whatever website, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, et cetera, Morehouse, certainly, they'll find these are 12 very different kinds of people in all kinds of different vocations, none of them clergy. And none of them, I think, probably would say they wear their religion on their sleeve, but they're very faithful people. And I think I wanted to kind of expand that opportunity to say, here are 12 people who also have so much the world has to offer, and yet have come to believe the most important things in life, again, are their family, their friends, and their faith.
So let's take that a step further, Russ. How did you go about choosing those 12? Why those 12?
Sure. Well, I say in the preface, Chris, you may have this in your podcast. I said, for every one who said yes, three said no. So I should begin with that. And so I had some very nice no's. You know, people said they were busy or this wasn't what they want to do at this time in their life or whatever. Some of these folks I knew pretty well from just over the years. Fortunate, felt blessed to know some of them. I knew about them because of connections in the church or just what I had read about them and met them in other places. Some I did not know before we began this. I certainly did not know Denzel Washington, who was one of the first who said yes. I did not know Francis Collins, who's a wonderful, brilliant scientist, the head of the Human Genome Project. But somebody said, you know, you really ought to talk to him. My same experience with Dr. Jane Goodall, who's people know her name. Anybody our age or older or probably younger know who Dr. Goodall is. But again, somebody else said, well, I didn't know you were doing this, but you really ought to. In fact, it was my wife who kind of leaned on him. He said, I read a lot of Dr. Jane Goodall. You need to talk to her. And then Ambassador Nikki Haley, I knew barely, but I knew enough to invite her. I didn't know if everybody would say yes. But at the end, we ended up with 12, which is a pretty good number. That's what my boss picked. So, and again, I really like, you know, you've got Dr. Collins, you've got a scientist and Dr. Collins. Jane Goodall does not like to call herself a scientist. She says she's a naturalist. You have two secretaries of state, Condi Rice and Secretary Jim Baker. You have two actors in Sam Waterston and Gary Sinise. You have a wonderful sports commentator and just the world of sports, Jim Nance. You have Britt Hume, and folks know through his commentary and his journalistic work. Again, Gary Sinise, Sam Waterston, singer-songwriter Amy Grant, who has become a good friend over the years, and then William McRaven, who is a wonderful national hero to me, and was behind the ultimate takedown of Osama bin Laden, but also a lot of people don't know that he was behind the capture of Saddam Hussein and also behind the rescue of Captain Phillips. I mean, his incredible story. His books are much more interesting than mine. But I also knew all of these people in their own way, had an incredible faith journey, lived their faith in their day-to-day lives, and all of them kind of land in the same place, that their faith is their most important thing, which was quite inspiring to me, frankly. Being ordained pastor for 32 years, priest, you know, Chris, I think I walked away from every one of these discussions thinking I still have a long way to go. I mean, these are people who are really, the youngest is Nikki Haley, 53. The eldest was Jim Baker, 95. And they're all still growing and learning and exploring their faith. And I walked away from everyone really inspired.
So I want to talk about some of them in a little more depth, Russ, because as I was looking at the cover of the book and doing a little bit of research on it, I was immediately drawn to Condoleezza Rice for being the right. former Secretary of State, and how impressive that obviously is. To me, even more impressive, she's a member at Augusta National. Well, right. What did you learn about her and her faith when you got an opportunity to spend some time with her?
Right. Well, she, as you know, she loves to golf. She's a member of, I've now retired to Birmingham, Alabama. She's a member of at least two of the country clubs here. I know where, in fact, somebody saw her out playing a few weeks ago here in Birmingham. You know, I had met her briefly, at the funerals, but I mean, that's the extent of it. And so, but she did grow up here in Birmingham. So she had close ties to some folks here in Birmingham who ultimately helped get me in touch with her. And I have to say, Chris, these people were so generous with their time and their approachability, which once I kind of weighed out my case, I mean, I did have to explain what I was trying to do, but her father was a pastor, she grew up in the church, and it was always part of her life, but she would say, and what we have here, 12 interviews, I sat down with most of them I was able to fortunately sit down with one-on-one. Some of like Dr. Goodall travels the world, so we had to do hers virtually. Secretary Rice is in California at Stanford. But we had a wonderful virtual visit. We prayed together at the end. But you know, I think the thing that so impressed me was how much she desires in her work and her service as Secretary of State and now as the director of the Hoover Institute to make a difference in the world. In fact, she said that, you know, one of her primary prayers in the morning is, Lord, you know, Lord, use me this day to do something for you. Help me to be the conduit that you want me to be. But here's the, when you say her specifically, I think here's the thing that really stuck out with me, Chris, is, you know, I would, as you do probably, I would kind of gauge how far do I go? How much do I ask? How deep do we explore? And fortunately, every single person was willing to do that. But I, you know, she would say, I said, tell me a little bit about your prayer life. And from the book, she would say something like, well, you know, I get up in the morning, have a very busy day. And often that's a very short prayer, but I do always begin my day with prayer. She said, throughout the day, I have what she called them tiny prayers. Well, Lord, help me get through this, or give me wisdom, or help me to be somebody who helps in this circumstance. But then, Chris, we got to the end, and she says, so here's what I pray at the end of the day. And she began to give me this wonderful litany of things. And I thought, well, here's this person, incredibly busy, has incredible responsibility, and yet she ends every day with this prayer for everything from peace in the world to people she knows are suffering, and then ends with the Lord's Prayer. So I said, well, you know, Secretary Rice, do you mind if I ask where do you pray? How do you go about that? And she said, oh, well, I kneel. I kneel when I say my prayers. And I said, and so, you know, at the end of the day, and she kind of said, well, oh, let me back up. She said, let me explain. When I was in Washington, that was a busy job. And I thought, yeah, I imagine it was. And she said, we worked, you know, long 14, 16, 17 hour days. And I would come in at the end of the day. I was so touched by this. I would come in at the end of the day and I'd have dinner and, you know, I'd get settled and get before bed. I would kneel down to say my prayers, but I was often so exhausted, I would fall asleep kneeling while I was saying my prayers. And so I realized that her response to that was not to quit. Her response to that was, but my prayers are really important to me. So I changed that such that then until now, when I come home at the end of the day, before I do anything else, I go in my bedroom, I kneel down and I say my prayers, and I end with the Lord's Prayer. And then I go on with my evening. Well, Chris, you know, it was a beautiful discussion, and we finished and prayed together, and then kind of hung up, and I immediately reached out to my wife and I said, you know, I've got a long way to go. This is really impressive. I mean, this is just so touching to me. And that she was so open about that.
You quote Denzel Washington, who said that he wants God to be in charge of everything and to take him to where God wants him to go. And I love the idea that he's kind of letting go of the reins and is willing to let God guide his footsteps. That's not easy to do. I ask God to do the same thing for me every day. Talk about that with Denzel and the other things that he shared with you.
Yeah, that's been I've been a huge admirer of his. Of all these people, I'm impressed with everyone. I have to be honest, say of all the 12, I was the most starstruck probably. And I reached out and did not know if I'd hear anything. And from the letter until, frankly, the voicemail, which was probably 6 months later. So I thought perhaps nothing was going to happen. And my wife and I were actually leading a group of church members on a kind of a pilgrimage to Normandy, the beaches of Normandy, of all places. And we were on this trip, and I looked down and I had a voicemail, and he, called and said, I've got your letter and I've thought about this and I want to do it. I include the exact transcript actually in the book. And he said, but I don't know when we're going to do it. I'm a really busy guy. He said, I'm getting ready to go leave for a movie in Morocco and Malta, which was Gladiator 2, by the way. He said, I was getting ready to film. He didn't say, I'm going to film Gladiator 2. He said, I'm off to film a movie. But we'll do this. And so we did. I actually flew out to Los Angeles and we met there. We talked several times on the phone before, during, right up to, and after. And again, I think here's one of the things that really struck me about him, even in my kind of moment of being starstruck. You know, he walked in. I had up to that point, I had called him Mr. Washington because I thought that was appropriate. And he walked in and I said, well, Mr. Washington, I'm glad this is finally happening. And he immediately opened his arms and said, no, Denzel, man, give me a hug. And we sat down, we kind of did the small talk. He said, well, shouldn't we pray first? I mean, he was the one who said, shouldn't we start with prayer? Which we did. And then he just began to talk about he's had an incredible career. But he talks about a moment when he was 20 years old and he was in his mother's beauty parlor working. And a woman named Ruth Green came in and looked at him and wrote something down on a piece of paper that someday you will preach to millions of ears around the world. And I'm not saying exactly the way he said it, but he did say, you know, of course, I thought at 20 years old, who is this crazy woman? And he said, but now I'm almost 70 and I have the opportunity to speak to people around the world. And what I want them to know is you should always put God first. He said, I've learned that in my almost 70. He was almost, he's 70 now, but he said, I'm almost 70 years, that is the way to live your life. You put God first. Those are the most important things. He said, I don't need any more money. I don't need any more recognition. I don't need any more Oscars. I really don't care about those things. What I need more and more in my life is God. And I will tell you something interesting happened, and he allowed me to put this in the book because we interviewed in July of last year, and then I noticed some other people did too, is socially kind of out there on the web and other places. But he got baptized in December of last year, and I thought, well, something happened. it's not that I knew he was a believer, but I said, this obviously he chose to make an important decision or step. And I said, I called him and I said, hey, can we have kind of a postscript interview? And again, it was back and forth. He was playing Othello in a play in New York. Some of your listeners probably saw him. And interestingly enough, again, here's a man at 69, I'm 63 and change, rolled over in the morning and he had called me at 3 a.m. and he said, I'm just getting in from work. He said, I'm working 18 hours a day right now. And we'll do this, but I just have to, you know, find the space to do it. A couple weeks after that. So we did, got on the phone and actually FaceTime and had a great conversation and scheduled a follow-up. And I said, well, tell me about the baptism. And he said, well, you know, I grew up in Harlem. My dad was a preacher at this church in Harlem. And we have a place in New York. And I got up on a Saturday morning and I decided I'm going to drive over to Dad's church. I want to see that church. And just early on a Saturday morning in his car, he got across town, pulled up in front of the church and saw the door kind of cracked open. And so he said, I got out, got in, walked in the church and they were having a youth scholarship event. And he said, I just kind of sat in the back of the church. He said, of course, by the end, I was giving away scholarships. He said, as I sat there, I realized I wanted to be baptized in my dad's church. And he had other very important spiritual moments in his life in church, but it just struck him that was kind of a important moment. And he did. I would encourage your people, you can actually go find it on YouTube. It was a very moving service. There weren't a lot of people there. And then he, you know, we all baptize in different ways. I'm Episcopal, so some sprinkle and some dunk, but they dunk there. So he got dunked. And Chris, he came up and the pastor gave him a chance to say something. He said something really just beautiful. And I asked Denzel, I said, so, you know, this is out there, so it's okay if I print it. He said, yes. And he just ended by saying, you know, I believe God is good all the time. I believe God is with us when we are not with him. I believe God is for us when we are not for him. He watches over us when we don't watch him. He protects us when we don't protect ourselves. He gives to us when we don't deserve it. And he went on to say how thankful he was for everything God had done for him. And he said, God has done a lot for me, but he'll do a lot for anyone who trusts in him. And he said, you may not be an actor or somebody famous, but with God, like we say, he said, the sky is literally the limit, and there's no limit to the sky. I mean, it's not just poetic, and he didn't read this off a script. It really came from his heart, and it's really touching. I mean, just to, again, these are people who have everything the world tells us is important, but they know. James Baker, as you mentioned, Secretary Baker, who has become a friend, actually, he's very kindly invited me to hunt with him several times, which has been an incredible experience. I apologize to people who don't like hunting, but so Secretary Baker says in the interview we had, he said, Russ, there's we don't have any say about when we're brought into this world, and we don't have any say about when we leave this world. He said, but we do have a lot of say about how we'll use that time in between. And I think we're supposed to use that to make a difference.
Amy Grant had a very traumatic bike accident in 2022. Yeah. She's always had a very strong faith, but talk about her brain injury and how she recites scripture now.
Yeah. She probably want me to say she just went back on the road. She's got a new album out. I guess we call those albums. just age myself. Yeah. She has a new 8-track tape out. No, just kidding. But she's very excited about that. So, but yes, the injury a couple of years ago, and it was pretty well known. Once it was kind of slowly revealed, people, you know, she knew she had an accident. People didn't know how bad it was. And it was pretty significant. And she says, and I think I did include this in every interview, right up until that point, her life was getting busier, kind of more frantic and more a lot going on. And she said, one of the first things she said when she regained consciousness after the accident is she looked at one of her friends and said, you know, I needed this, which is a remarkable thing to say, because she knew she would have to stop everything for a while. And so it did impact her ability to remember as well as she would, as any singer would want to remember. In fact, about a year after that, she came very kindly, and she and her wonderful band came and did a concert for the parish where I was serving at the time, St. Martin's in Houston, before I retired. And I noticed that she was turning to her backup folk for, you know, to kind of be coached a little bit. And she finally said it to the audience. She said, you all have probably noticed, you know. But yeah, you're right. So in our interview, which was at her home in the Tennessee area, we talked for a long time, and I kind of went through the same thing. I asked her about what did her devotional life look like? In the same way I asked Secretary Rice. And she said, well, you know, it's changed a lot over the years. I do different things. I pray in different ways. And I said, do you have a favorite scripture? And she said, yes, but you know, I've come to where I like to sing the scriptures. It's easier for me to kind of remember it when I sing, which makes sense. And then she turned to me and said, it was just the two of us. So she goes, can I sing for you? I said, what? Absolutely. Is there a charge? Are we going to do that at the end? And I said, of course. And Chris, she very softly began to sing, in the beginning was the Word, and Word was with God, and the Word was God, which is from John's Gospel. Kind of got through the end of that. And it was very beautiful and tender, but she said that, and that's the way I began my morning. She's very, opaque is not the right word. She's very transparent. She, of course, is married to an incredible artist in his own right, Vince Gill, and they have a very busy, both of them, busy lives in their own way. And yet they're very different kinds of people, which I discovered more through the interview. She might have said it in other places. But I did say to her, you know, gosh, you know, incredible lives and very busy. They are in their second marriages, and that's a whole different story I talk a little bit about in the book, but they've been together a long time. And I said, you know, there's no dark story about Vince Gill and Amy Grant, as there is to a lot of people in your business. We might want to come back to that on Sam Waterston, because he said some interesting things there. But, and I said, so what's your secret? You know, what would you say to young people getting into marriage? And she said, well, I'm a talker, probably the way Chris Mascaro and Russell Evanson are. People talk for a living. She said, I talk everything out. I like to talk. I like to get it all my thoughts out. And she said, one day we were in the car. I was just going off and off and saying all kinds of things. And Vince was being very quiet. And I got to the end, and I'm not saying this exactly right. The exact script is in the book, but she said, I got to the end and Vince was real quiet. And he said something like, you know, Amy, I'm not sure exactly what you want me to say right now, but I do want you to know that I will always be here for you. And she said that alone did a lot for her. She said, and she looked to me, she said, kindness goes a long way. And I thought, well, wow.
Indeed. Great.
Yeah.
You mentioned Jane Goodall a little while ago, and she is somebody that I have immense respect for. She talks about how God gives us inner strength, courage, and determination not to give in when humankind is faced with immense suffering. Right. And I find that very interesting, because I think that's what a lot of people point to as the reason why they don't have faith. Now, how can there be a God when there's so much suffering going on? Talk about how God, in your conversation with her, you know, he's always there with us in the valleys in life. Yeah. He's not going to maybe prevent the valley from happening, but right. He's going to go down into the valley and be there with us as we're going through it.
Yeah. Yeah. I, as I began in the book, I do say we've got several people here who have really been through tough times. And when Gary Sinise, and I would say we've become friends over the years through a number of different things, but Gary's doing incredible work through his foundation. Oh my word, what he does for wounded warriors and veterans and first responders. But his son, Mac, had just died a few months before we sat down. And we talked a lot about that in our time together. Britt Hume, the suicide of his son, Sandy, which was incredible blow to him. And then of course, Jane Goodall has been through ups and downs over the years. I think one of the things that I so admire about her, she's, you know, of course, very cognizant and distressed about the way in which our world is being polluted and the environment is being challenged, it seems like, on every front. And you know, humans are getting more and creation's getting smaller, it seems like, in many ways. And so you would think at age 91 and change, she might be the person who's going around giving kind of bitter, angry speeches. But she's not. She's reminding people when faced with darkness, do something in response. And it doesn't have to be a giant kind of world-changing moment. It can be. If you have the power to change legislation or make policy different, great. But she talks about the little differences you can make in your community, at the school where your children might go. And so she sent my wife and I, we've stayed in touch with her. She's still traveling everywhere. She sent us the sweetest little note a few weeks ago. And she said, the world can be a dark and place at times, and it can seem like darkness is all around us, but there is something we can do. And that is, we can at least pray. And she says, to the great spiritual power, which you and I call God. And I think the reason I included her, frankly, Chris, and I only put kind of purposely one at the beginning, one at the end, all the others are kind of random. But I put her at the end because she and I don't know the date of this, but it was in the last couple of years. And this is when my wife had heard it. And she said, you really need to see if you can talk to her. But she was given a lecture, and she will bring in huge crowds, particularly of young people at college campuses. She was just in Austin last week speaking, and people love to hear her speak, and great sense of humor. And she said, and so there's sometimes a Q&A. And so at this Q&A, somebody said, well, Dr. Goodall, you know, you've had this incredible, fascinating life, all these adventures. What's your next great adventure? And she just kind of paused and smiled and said, well, death. And she said, you know, the audience kind of got quiet, like, well, that, where are you going with this? And she said, if you believe in life after death, which I do, what could be a greater adventure than this? And we know it's going to be greater than this. And I said, that's the way I want to end the book. And so in our interview, when we got to the very end, I said, well, you know the question I'm going to ask. She started laughing. And she said, well, of course I know the question, because that's why you asked me to be in the book. So, I kind of end the book by saying, you know, follow in the steps of these people and come to know what they've come to know, and then get ready for the next great adventure.
You mentioned this a little bit ago, but you start the book off with Dr. Francis Collins, and he's the one who discovered that genes are associated with a number of diseases, and he led the Human Genome Project. Yet despite being a scientist, he believes that science points us towards there being a creator, something you wouldn't necessarily believe that he would do. Talk about what you learned from him.
Yeah, and he knows this, so I'm not saying anything, although he and I are going to do a program together in Washington on October 13th at Christ Church in Georgetown, Washington, in just a few weeks. But has so since have become, you know, people who know one another, and I have vast respect for him. He was the head of the Human Genome Project, and grew up a scientist, and he would say openly, his books are wonderful too, by the way, the Language of God and his recent book on wisdom, both really incredible books. But he said, I grew up an atheist. You know, we were not believers in my home. He said, I grew up in a great home. And he said, there's nothing, you know, we had a happy home. We played music and valued education. I decided to be a doctor and love science. And he said, but it just never occurred to me to really believe in God, let alone a specific God in the Christian faith. But then he was in the middle of his medical school work and his training as a doctor, and he was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And he said, I began to run into all kinds of people who talk about their faith, and I really didn't, you know, I would listen. He said, but there was one woman in particular, an elderly woman who he really took a shine to, and they would have conversations. Well, one day he's in her hospital room and she just begins talking to him. Those of us in the Bible Belt would say she's witnessing, as I'm trying to do with this book. She's telling about her faith in a very loving, gentle, kind of sweet way. And he's listening and listening, and she gets to the end and she says, well, Dr. Collins, what do you believe? And he said, you know, suddenly I realized I was on thin ice. You know, here I was, a scientist, somebody who believed in empirical evidence, and I realized I had never taken the time to consider the evidence in the world around us. And he said, then as I began to explore it, and certainly through my own love of creation and science, and even the DNA strand, he said, I began to believe in a creator. And I grew in my faith. And if people know the story of C.S. Lewis, it was not an overnight journey. And it wasn't for Dr. Collins. It was almost 2 years before he kind of opened that door to faith, and then, as he would say, really became a committed Christian. But it wasn't in the way many people perhaps see in the movies or at church. You know, there was no music, there was no altar call. He said he was actually on a hike, and just kind of came across a frozen waterfall, and he said it just all kind of came together for him. And he believed not just in the God of creation, but for him, he gave his life to Christ as a follower, and he believes creation points to the Creator, not away from him. He's an incredible bright, as you would imagine. I feel pretty humble and around him, but at the same time, he's got a great sense of humor. He's a musician, while I prayed with all of these folks, of the 12. When we got finished, I asked him to pray. And he was very comfortable and offered a beautiful prayer, which I actually included in the book.
So, Russ, we talk about him being first, and you mentioned Jane Goodall being at the end. Was there significance to why you wanted to start the book off with the scientist? And essentially, you said Jane Goodall likes to talk about being a naturalist and not a scientist. Mm-hmm. But you've got two scientists and everybody else in between. Was there significance to why you wanted to lead with a scientist and end with one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Dr. Collins, I think, came to faith in many ways by looking at Genesis, the beginning. And Dr. Goodall, in her great wisdom and her very broad understanding of faith, you know, all of these people, I think, Chris, are very careful to say, even though they, I will say, I'm a Christian, so if somebody was of a different tradition, they can do that. But and all these people are Christians in their own faith and traditions. So Dr. Goodall is very, you know, open as all these people. They would all say, I don't want everybody to think the way I did it is the way they have to do it. But I do make the point at the end of saying, yes, but they did do it. You know, yes, that's true. But they in their beautiful stories. And so to end with Dr. Goodall reminding us that there's a next great chapter is the way I wanted it. You know, I will say somebody who really, I mean, they all just had a great impact. I'm still kind of chewing on things that they said, even the book's done and printed and I'm going back through it. But Sam Waterston, who played, you know, Law and Order forever, but was very well known for Great Gatsby and The Killing Fields and several other films he was in. But is a lifelong Episcopalian and a lifelong believer who went through seasons of rebellious doubt, I guess he would say. But then, you know, and again, he says, I'm not saying the moment somebody says to me, you've got to believe the way I do, I kind of resist that. But at the same time, he began with kind of an essay. He said, I've never really talked about this in the way I'm going to talk about it in this book. So I'm going to give you an essay that I've written for this book. And then we'll do the Q&A. And it's a beautiful essay, frankly. And right in the middle of it, he writes these words, I believe that to believe in God is just to admit the truth. And then he goes on to say, I believe the whole shebang. All it is here by intention, not by accident. It's just a beautiful reflection on that. And again, I said he and his wife Lynn have been married decades, and she's a lovely woman. And they invited us, my wife and I, to their home. So we stayed with them for a few days and ate and visited. And again, Sam, I mean, I was just so struck. Sam's practice of devotion is 30 minutes of meditation in the morning and 30 minutes in the evening. I mean, that's, you know, if I'm completely honest, at the end of the day, it's a glass of wine time. And what show are we going to watch? So I mean, with my wife, and here's Sam and Lynn, and it's very devoted way. They go to their church, they go to a small church, and they still open and giving in many ways. He's in mid 80s now, but he's still working, not near as much as he was, but I just really touched by that. And so I said to him, what's your secret? What, you and Lynn have been together. You can't scan the internet and find some dark story about Sam Waterston. He said, well, you know, lots of things. Yeah, I married the right woman. He just said, and she's been a blessing. You know, you can't beat love in marriage is what he said, I think. He said, and you know, I made a conscious decision to not live in Los Angeles or New York. I don't live. He lives in New England, and he's asked me not to say exactly where he lives, but he lives on a farm in New England in a very modest home, I should say. And he said that helps me keep perspective and grounded. He said, I have good friends, good family that I've been close to, but again, his faith. And I would say he's a person that's not stopped growing or just stopped trying to understand. He's actually doing the launch with me, for me, I should say. He's very kind enough to, I'm doing it with him, I should say, at Christchurch in Greenwich, Connecticut on October the 4th in the evening. We're doing a program together. And, but the other day he was kind of pitching ideas. Well, why don't we go this direction? You know, people are probably expecting it to go this way. Why don't we go this way? And, but I just very touched by how, you know, to go back to Amy's words, how kind he is and how kind his wife Lynn is and how important their faith is to them.
Russ, one more before I let you go.
Sure.
What is it you're hoping that people are ultimately going to take away from reading this new book?
Yeah. I, you know, Chris, I don't think anybody would say, anybody with any brain matter would say right now, we're not living through a difficult generation, generational season in the life of our, if not our nation, our world. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of, I think, angst. I think there's, in some ways, many ways, people have forgotten how to speak with one another, how to live with one another. I think the way we find that, and I'm not saying this just because I'm a pastor and a priest, but I'm a Christian. I think the way we find that is by being in relationship, a personal relationship with the one who created us and loves us and redeems us and wants to spend eternity with us. And here are 12 people who, in their own ways, these are not cookie cutter paths to the Almighty, have found that place to go to find that strength. And so I'm hoping that people who don't believe at all, you know, they don't have any belief system at all, but they might walk by a bookstore and see this and think, what is Denzel Washington and Jane Goodall and Nikki Haley doing in front of a book together and with Jim Nantz and Gary Sinise and Amy Grant? What are they all doing? I know them from the news or their career or their vocation. And my hope is they'll think, well, those people have everything. You know, they have what the world has to offer. And I'm hoping they'll crack it open and go, wow, they do, but they have what's the most important thing to them is not those things. It is the things that we can't buy, the things that we can't earn, the things that sustain us. So if you're not a believer, in much the same way people picked up the Bush book and wrote me and said, gosh, if they can do it, maybe I should do it. That they'll look at the lives of these 12 incredibly generous, loving, giving people and say, well, if they can do it, maybe I ought to give it a try. And then for people who do believe, as you and I do, my hope is they'll, as I have done, they might read that Sam Waterston spends an hour a day in meditation and they might say, oh, I might ought to give a little more time to this. Or Condi Rice, you know, kneels by our prayer a bed every night. Amy Grant sings the scripture. Gary Sinise spends every waking hour giving to others. Or Jim Nantz is an incredible person whose voice we all know, but he's made sure that people's lives are changed. And the disease of Alzheimer that his father sadly succumbed to at the end is turned around but through his foundation. I mean, all of these people are an inspiration to me, and I hope they will be to others.
Russ, remind our listeners again when the book is going to be available. Sure. And how they can go about getting their copy of it.
Every author loves to be asked that question. It says, Witness to Believe, Conversations on Faith and Meaning. And you can get it, you know, you can order it now, early release on Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, Morehouse, who's the great publisher and cheerleader, Target, Walmart, all the places you get online books. But they're in the stores as well. And but it releases the first week of October. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about it. I hope people will purchase it. We're coming up. I do think it'll make a great kind of Christmas gift or Hanukkah gift or gift for the upcoming holiday season for people. I hope it's something somebody will sit down with a cup of coffee in the morning and leave, you know, over a period of days and think, wow, I think I've learned a lot about what life really means.
And Russ, how can they follow you online and on social media as well?
I'm just kind of developing that. I'm on the Morehouse website. I do have an author page. I think it's Russell Evanson. And so those kinds of things are being built. There's a lot of stuff out there as anyone. I have learned, as you probably have, the more social media there is, the less people are reading it. So, but I'm happy for people to follow, look, read. And I, you know, the thing that helps, of course, authors is when you get on a website, purchase it, and then go back and offer a review. So that, I think those reviews help other people pick up the page.
Well, Russ, it's always great having you as part of the show. I hope we get this privilege with you again before too long. You're fantastic, my friend.
You are too. Thank you. Really a gift. Thank you for being together.
Take care, Russ. All the best to you and your family. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
See you, Russ. That is the great Dr. Russell Levinson, folks. And look, three fantastic books of his now. I've got two of them, read those. Now I'm looking forward to the next one. But Witness to Dignity, The Life and Faith of George H.W. Bush and Barbara Bush, was a wonderful read. And I had a wonderful conversation with Russ the last time he was on the show about that book. In God's Grip, What Golf Can Teach Us About the Bible, another fantastic read. And I can't wait to get the new one. Again, Witness to Believe, Conversations on Faith and Meaning. What sounds like a wonderful collection of 12 people from different walks of life talking about what's the most important thing. And what is the most important thing? Well, how you worship, how you pray, and then how you're a positive impact on the people that you run across in life, right? Not just your friends, not just your family, but the other people that you have an opportunity to interact with and meet along life's journey, positively impacting all of those. These sounds like 12 great stories that I can't wait to crack open and read a little bit more about, read more in detail about, and then hopefully catch up with Russ a little bit later on in the year. As he talked about, what a great book to give to folks this holiday season and to help ourselves along our journey. And the part that we got into a little bit about with Jane Goodall, right? I mean, these are hard times. Russ talked about it too. These are hard times, and we need the inspiration. We need to feel more connected to one another. I think social media has done a disservice to our society by really more driving a wedge between us than to bring us together. And I think really that was where social media was supposed to go. We remember back to the days when Facebook got started. It was really to bring us together with family and friends and give us a way to interact with one another across the miles. And unfortunately, people have gone to great lengths to try to make it more divisive than it is a unity factor. And well, he talked about that with Jane Goodall, and hopefully we can do a better job of that, but positively impact each other and be an inspiration to others. I think that's really the foundation of what Russ is trying to get across here with these stories. But I look forward to having him back on the show again before too long. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this very special edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks go out again to Brian Klosik, Reese Jones, John Mahaffey, and Dr. Russell Levinson for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are Darren Davis, a superintendent from Old Florida Country Club, will make his Next on the Tee debut. Oakmont and really Western Pennsylvania golf historian David Moore will be back, as will former PGA Tour pro Kenny Knox. Always a great time when Kenny's a part of the show. So it's going to be a fun one, folks. I hope you'll come back and join us for it. I want to thank our friends again over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. For coverage of everything going on in Western Pennsylvania, including your favorite sports, go to triblive.com. You can find this show by clicking on the sports section tab, and the most recent episode is going to be front and center for you right there on the homepage of the sports section. Or you could click on Sports and then Podcast Network. You'll then see the Next on the Tee logo. Click on that, and many of the most recent episodes from this season are going to be right there for you. You can also find this show pretty much everywhere you get your podcast content, including out on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and GolfNewsNet.com. And as always, huge thank you to the wonderful folks over at Good Pods for making this one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But like I say, each and every episode, the biggest thanks go out to each and every one of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate each and every one of you so very much. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Thanks for joining Chris again this week on Next on the Tee. We hope you enjoyed the conversations as much as we did. Please share the show with your golf buddies and be sure to follow it on Trib Live or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Thanks for pressing play and being part of the journey. We'll see you next week, right here, where the best minds in golf share their stories.